Serkan agreed to pass along to Brunn a message which made no sense to her, but would, Harris hoped, make sense to that inventive young lady. Brunn's answer, relayed through Serkan, showed she had done her homework. She had also had her visit with Cecilia, and she believed Cecilia's coma was not as deep as the medical records indicated.
How did she get hold of the medical records? Never mind. If she says Lady Cecilia is still alive inside, I'll believe it. And if she thinks she can arrange a rescue, we'll get out of her way and let her at it.
Serkan was looking better these days, and her sparkle had begun to come back. Harris wondered momentarily if it was just time, or if Brunn had anything to do with it. She had to admit the two of them seemed to hit it off well.
But it's dangerous, and if they catch her...
If they catch her, she's young, rich, titled, and will have Kevil Mahoney on her side. I'd bet on her not to get caught, though. You didn't see her on the island. I was impressed.
I wish I had.
And Brunn wished she knew as much about ships. Harris wondered what would come of this. She hoped it wouldn't cause them any trouble more serious than young people usually had. Next, Harris went to find Oblo.
I've got our slot. The families requested that the yacht be put in deep storage. The court agreed. Space Enhance doesn't want the responsibility of moving it, and I've refused to allow a ferry crew, under provisions of my employment contract with Lady Cecilia and my rights as possible heir. The court agreed to that, too. Suspicious, but they did agree. So we're to move her.
But what about stores? If you're planning to go out system at once...
Are you telling me that the best thief I ever knew can't manage to get a few cargo cubes aboard a yacht guarded by an interior decorator?
Well, no, but it won't be easy. Those people are strange.
Oh, you've been checking?
Oblo looked up at the ceiling.
Of course. You said get ready for a quick departure, so I thought I'd ease things. Turns out they have an almighty sticky AI on their dock gate.
But you can do it.
Unless you're planning to run a year without stopping anywhere, she's fit.
He didn't look at her directly, but she knew his face too well to be fooled. He had begun shifting provisions into the yacht long before. It had probably started simply to prove he could bugger the AI.
Now?
I'd like another 3 shifts to sort of finish things off, but we could go now and not be much shorter.
Good. You can have 3 shifts, but not a second more, and you'd better not get caught.
Oblo looked insulted at that, as well he might.
And that includes weaponry.
No problem.
Right then. We file a flight plan for 8 shifts from now.
Oblo scowled, and Harris pointed at him.
Think about it. You're going to be sure they're as stupid as you think. If you've been doing something every shift or so, 5 blanks will make them show themselves, especially with a plan filed. I'll have reserved our space in Rockhouse Miner's deep storage and tickets back here on the ferry. Show up in uniform. We're Lady Cecilia's employees and not a gang of toughs who might go larking off somewhere in her ship. Very formal, very sad. Look as grim as you like. You're miserable about this, and you don't mind saying so. But not in the bars yet. Not until the last night.
Harris had no trouble looking grim as she filed the flight plan. Everyone knew about the legal dispute. This would make it clear who was winning. The traffic head clerk had been on Rockhouse for years. She had filed fleet plans with him.
Tough luck, Captain. It's disgusting the way they've messed up what the old lady intended.
Lady Cecilia was a fine woman. And I only hope they don't scour the tubes when they shut the main drive down over there.
Oh, you're not going to Dubley's?
No. Lady Cecilia's family insists that's not cost-effective, since they don't foresee the ship being used for several local years, and possibly sold anyway. As you see, they specified Harrigan's.
The clerk would know what that meant, in credits and in skill. Harrigan's was a fine deep storage yard if you were planning to send a ship or sell it to someone who would be doing a major overhaul anyway. Dubley's, far more expensive, boasted it could power and air up a ship from deep storage in less than 50 hours.
A shame. A lovely ship, I've heard.
It is. You know, she had just had it redone when I first took command, and she was having it redone again.
His eyes widened. He wanted even more details.
Real wood paneling, furnishings brought up from the family estate. And it was impressive before.
I know. Space Enhance has been using the interiors in their advertising. That was their top designer. I wonder why she wanted to change it.
Because she could, I suppose. Perhaps it didn't have the effect she expected. But you see what I mean.
The clerk nodded as if that had meant something and sealed the flight plan with a coded magnetic strip. On the way back from the traffic control office, a short, brown-haired young woman stopped her at a slideway entrance.
Captain Serrano?
Her face and voice were slightly familiar. Harris paused.
Yes?
I don't expect you to remember me. I was just a very junior ESR-12.
Military. Environmental systems technician enlisted. With the specialty and rank, the name came back to her.
Yes. Vivi Skoderin.
Another reminder of her earlier failure, though Skoderin might have been junior enough to escape the court's martial that devastated the officers and NCOs of her former crew.
How have you been? Did you...
They didn't send me to prison, no, ma'am. But I didn't re-up.
Find a job all right?
Well, ma'am, I just got in. Been working on a bulk transport. Independent carrier, Oslin Brothers, maybe you know of them?
Oslin Brothers meant nothing to Harris, but independent carriers of bulk cargo were marginal profit concerns. She shook her head.
I was hoping for something better. Scuttlebutt around station is you have your own ship and are hiring some of your former crew, and I was wondering...
Harris didn't need this, not now. But responsibilities didn't come when you needed them. At least she could get this woman a square meal and perhaps a little money to help her find a better berth.
Scuttlebutt's got it slightly wrong, as usual. But come on, at least have lunch with us. You remember Sergeant Meharry and Oblo?
Something flickered in Skoderin's eyes, but Harris dismissed it as recognition.
They'll be glad to see you. Come on now.
Skoderin climbed onto the slideway with her, and Harris spent the trip back to the hostel thinking furiously. What would she do now? She owed Skoderin, as she owed all her former crew. And they were short in environmental tech, as Haidar had reminded her only that week. The others were willing to do the work, but in an emergency, they'd have their own stations to keep. Haidar remembered Skoderin at once, which relieved Harris. What if the woman had been planted on them somehow?
You'll bring her along, won't you, Captain? We really need another tech. I could use two more, in fact.
You're sure of her?
Oh, yes. That's Vivi. Kind of dull, except for her work. She's absolutely reliable. She got top reports from Lieutenant Ganaba.
Lieutenant Ganaba, who had been killed on the island even before the hunt started. Harris had heard the story from Petrus. The Admiral had not liked to leave officers alive as effective leaders. And Ganaba had been tough. If he approved of Skoderin, then she was good.
Seems a good solution to me. But if we ask her, she has to say yes. We can't leave her behind to tell the tale.
Just tell her we're ferrying the yacht, and not the rest of it.
But that's like hijacking her.
Hell, Captain, we're going to kidnap a prince. Why not an environmental tech? Besides, she wants a berth.
And Skoderin offered a short-time job ferrying the yacht with maybe a longer job later, agreed at once. Haidar took her off to lunch himself, waving away Harris's offer of funds. With the flight plan filed and the Sweet Delight entered into the undock sequencer, time seemed to compress. Harris had her own list to complete. Check out of the hostel, with reservations for herself at another, lower-priced hostel for the end of the week. Consigning the letter's patent to Kevil Mahoney's office downside. She sweated out the hours until he called to confirm receipt. The messenger service was supposed to be secure, but one never knew. She had avoided telling Space Enhance about the new orders, lest they send someone aboard to do something and find what Oblo had stashed. So at the last reasonable time, when she was due aboard to begin the undocking procedures, she stopped by the Space Enhance office and showed her official authorization.
But you can't.
Court orders it. Long-term storage has been arranged at Harrigan's, Bay 85. I'm due aboard to begin undock in 10 minutes.
But...
I don't see the problem. You had the cease-work order more than 40 days ago. Surely the ship's just sitting there empty, isn't it?
Well, yes, but I'll have to check with the manager.
Not the manager, Harris noted, but a manager. Soon, the man Harris had seen before came out of the back rooms.
Oh, Captain Serrano. How nice. Mill tells me you're moving Lady Cecilia's yacht into deep storage. Does this mean the quarters ruled against you?
Not yet. just until the case is heard and finally settled. Her family petitioned the court, and the court agreed.
Well, that's too bad. Such a lovely ship. We can have her ready for you in, another 24 hours? How's that?
Sorry. I've got to undock starting in 8 minutes. We're on the sequencer, and we have a flight plan. The Harrigan's berth is time-logged, and we have passage back to Major on Triamnos. If you'll just give me the access codes.
But, Captain, the ship isn't... It's not ready. You know, we had to stop in the middle of...
Hera shrugged. She had expected Space Enhance to try some kind of delay, but this seemed silly.
As I told your assistant, you had the cease-work order weeks ago. Surely your people aren't using the ship.
Well, no, it's not that. It's just such a mess. We don't like to let even an unfinished job go out of here in that state.
Sorry, but this time you must.
Harris stared him down. The man seemed uncommonly flustered, and Harris wondered if Space Enhance was involved in some kind of smuggling and had been using the yacht as a storage bay. If so, they were about to be in real trouble, all of them.
Well, I suppose if you're on the sequencer.
Traffic control had a reputation for shredding anyone who fouled up the system, including station-side companies whose failure to comply with ship's orders caused the delay. Harris had never liked traffic control's tyranny, but this time she blessed it.
I'll just come with you.
Harris didn't argue. 6 minutes was cutting it close, even for her. The crew waited, looking as solemn and grim as Harris could have hoped, in formal dark blue. But the Space Enhance man hardly glanced at them, opening the gates and hatches one after another. Harris hardly had time to glance at the status board and see that it was safely green before the man opened the access hatch itself and started into it.
Excuse me. We really don't have much time before undock starts. If you could just get back to the dock.
Right.
Harris's suspicions went up another notch. She smiled anyway and led the way past the Space Enhance manager, trusting Oblo to make sure he didn't stay aboard. The ship smelled funny. She had expected a new smell, cleaning solutions or solvents or something like that, but this was a strange, yeasty odor. Perhaps that's what bothered Space Enhance. Maybe whatever they used to strip the carpets and wall coverings smelled bad, and they didn't want clients to know. The bridge still looked too tiny, especially with the new screens crammed into every spare corner. Before, it had looked like a toy. Now it looked like some electronics hobbyist's workbench. Harris took her seat and called traffic control. She could hear the crew moving into position. In her mind's eye, she followed them all to their stations.
Sweet Delight, Harris Serrano commanding, initiating undocking procedures.
Confirm your flight plan to Rockhouse Minor, Harrigan's long-term storage. Please accept course burst.
Accepting.
Harris shunted the course to Sirkin's board and went on with the interminable formalities of undocking from Rockhouse Major. Registration, ownership, insurance, ship's beacon profiles, accounting details. The cost of pursuing legal remedies against ships that left stations owing money meant that it was much easier to insist on clear accounts before they left. If so much as a single glass of ale were outstanding, the ship could lose her place in the sequence and be assessed a hefty fine to boot. After the formalities came the systems checks, which she watched carefully. The ship had been aired up the entire time, but something might still be wrong. At least she now had crew she trusted. All boards were green except the newest. Those would stay dark untouched until they had cleared the station. Those, if detected, could get them in trouble.
Tug approaching, channel 186.
Thanks.
Harris switched to the tug's channel. She would have preferred a hot start, but no civilian ship left Rockhouse Major under its own power. She checked to see that the yacht's bustle had been deployed. Petrus gave her a thumbs up. With no pilot, a rating not used on the fleet vessels, he had taken over some of those functions.
Captain Serrano, Sweet Delight.
The memory of the first time she'd said that, undocking here long months before, came to her. She felt very differently now.
Station tug 16, permission to grapple.
Harris was glad it wasn't the same tug. That would have been a bit too much coincidence.
Permission to grapple.
She felt the jar. Tug 16 was a lot clumsier than the earlier one. The status light switched through the color sequence and ended green.
All fast. Your port bustle coupling is a bit stretchy, though. On your signal.
She called traffic control on their channel.
Captain Serrano, sweet delight. Permission to undock on your signal.
All clear on station. Confirm all clear aboard.
Nothing but green on any of the boards. Her crew nodded.
All clear aboard.
20 seconds. She, the station master on watch in traffic control, and the tug captain all counted together, but the computer actually broke the connection to the station. She watched the display as the tug dragged them slowly away from the crowded traffic near Rockhouse Major. This would be a shorter tug, because they were headed for Minor on an in-system route. In fact, the tug could give them the correct vector and let them ride that trajectory most of the way to Minor. But Harris had chosen the more common option of powering up and hopping it. When the tug released them, she called for the in-system drive.
In-system drive, sir. Normal power up.
The lights flicked once as the internal power switched from the storage units to the generators working off the drive.
Engage.
Now the artificial gravity shivered momentarily, then steadied, as the in-system drive pushed them along the course handed out by traffic control. Not that they would stay on it long.
Turn on the new scanners.
Oblo reached up and did so. Now she had almost as much data on traffic in near space as traffic control. In-system space had no blind corners, no places where the sudden change in acceleration of a yacht would go unnoticed. As soon as they started their move away from assigned course, traffic control would be all over them. So might any fast-moving patrol craft, though none showed on the scans. It felt very strange. She had never, in her entire life, done anything intentionally wrong. Even as a child, she had always asked permission, always followed the rules. Well, most of the rules. She had cut herself off from the fleet for a good cause, she thought. Now she was cut off from all lawful society. She hoped the cause was good enough. She really hoped her mathematics was good enough. What they had was the advantage of small mass and initiative. The longer she waited, the less initiative. Petrus reached back and caught her hand.
You don't have to do this just to impress me. If you think it's wrong...
I think it's all wrong, but this is the least wrong part of it. No. We'll go and scandalize the fleet and then get blown away by a smuggler or something.
You don't really think that?
No. Not without a fight.
As always, cementing the responsibility, she made the move herself. Flat down on the board, the main drives answered smoothly, and the Sweet Delight, bouncing like a leaf in a rapid, skipped out of her plotted course. They needed another 10,000 kilometers. She sweated, watching the plots. It should take a few seconds to register. Someone should be tapping the screens, wondering what had happened to the plots. Then it would take time to transmit the message. No one had the right firing angle for missiles. No one could intercept with tractors before they got their critical distance. Optical weapons would fry them. No civilian vessel carried shields. But the overrun could be tricky. She knew there was traffic beyond them, bound on other routes. She had counted on that. Seconds ticked by. They still had the civilian beacon on. No use to play games with it in a system where their ID was known. Oblo smiled with grim satisfaction as one of his lights blinked red, then returned to green.
They stripped it, even though they should have known who we were.
Wondering. They're wondering what happened.
Not for long.
Course error. Course error. Contact traffic control officer at once.
Automatically, Harris's finger found the button, but she stopped it before the channel opened. When she glanced around, they were watching her. She pulled her hand back and shrugged.
Nothing to say. We'll wait it out.
At the edge of her vision, in front of Oblo, the counter ran down the long chain of numbers.
General warning. Vessel off course in Sector Red Alpha 2. All traffic alert. Do not change course without direct orders. Stand by for traffic control override.
The new scanners showed the reaction in color changes as other traffic dumped velocity or changed course. Harris had counted on that, too. Everyone believed in traffic control until something went wrong, at which point at least 20% of the captains would use their own judgment. Time after time, that had proven deadly, but it happened anyway. Now, traffic control had more to worry about than one yacht off course, as each panicky ship caused problems for others. The near-scan screens showed a face in fleet gray, with the insignia of an admiral on his shoulders. Martin's, it must be. He had just taken command of fleet at Rockhouse Major. He had served with the Lupescu, though she didn't know if they'd been friends.
Damn you, Serrano!
Harris stared back, impassive. Of course they knew, but she wasn't going to give him her visual.
I never thought even you would cripple an old woman just to get a free ride. We'll find you.
A threat she trusted, as she trusted a knife to be sharp. But it bit deep anyway. She made herself stare into those angry eyes until the beam cut off. Then she cut the link to traffic control herself. She didn't need that nonsense blaring at her. They weren't going to impede anyone's course more than another few seconds.
We're clear in theory.
Then let's surprise them.
With the new control systems, she had only one button to push. She wished she could have heard the comments from traffic control when their abrupt skip into FTL left an unstable bubble in the local space for others to avoid. They were still alive. She didn't think she'd ever heard of anyone using FTL drive that close to a planet, and she hadn't entirely trusted the theory that said it was possible for something of their mass. But they were alive, the sweet delight as solid as ever, and presumably they hadn't destroyed anything vital back there. She had gotten as far from the main stations as she could, although there were too many satellites up to avoid them all.
And now for a life of piracy and plunder, huh? Gold, girls, adventure.
Shut up. First, we have to find a quiet place to do a little cosmetic work on our friend here.
Harris tried to relax. Nothing could have followed them. Not even the escorts could have gone into FTL so close. Pursuit would have hours of boost to get out far enough, by which time they would have nothing to follow. They had slipped their leash. She looked around at her crew. They looked busy and outwardly calm, but she suspected more than one felt the same internal tremors she did. They had not set out in life to become criminals. Those who had been through the disastrous court-martial would be more hardened, but Sirkin... She glanced again at the young navigator. Sirkin had had a promising career before her, and no military background. Now she had lost her lover and her career. But the latter had been her own choice. Still, she must feel strange, the youngest and the only one without military experience, without years of working with Harris. But her face, when she turned to face Harris, seemed calm enough.
Captain, the new equipment's working well. I can really pick up navigation points, even here.
Here, being that indefinable location into which FTL drives projected.
Just remember that the apparent motion you'll see isn't right. When we drop out, we won't be where you would expect, but where the charts say.
Sirkin looked confused, and Harris didn't blame her. The military navigational gear which Oblo had liberated had counterintuitive properties which Sirkin would learn best by experience. The point of it was not to steer by the detected navigation nodes, but to detect other vessels in FTL state. They passed two more jump points safely, with no pursuit detected. Harris didn't fool herself that this meant no pursuit. It meant only successful and very temporary evasion. Finally, they returned to normal space, in a region with no known maintenance stations. As Petrus had said, they needed to do a bit of work on the yacht. Better Luck had been built at the same yards, within a year of Sweet Delight, the utility version of the same hull. She'd been modified for carrying very low-temperature cargo, then rebuilt to handle rough landings, then rebuilt again to return her to a deep-space freighter, reclaiming the cargo space lost to the landing gear. She had been lost to the finance company, which chose to scrap her rather than pay for refitting. The last cargo had rotted when the low-temp compartments failed, and the stench had gone into the deck tiling. Oblo had her registration number and her papers, or a reasonable facsimile, and the overall hull design matched. Now he was making sure the beacon matched too, and the little tramp freighter had never operated in this region of space.
I wonder how Lady Cecilia is, if Brunn's been able to do anything.
We all wonder.
Harris knew someone would have let Cecilia know she'd run off with the ship. She hated that, knowing Cecilia would feel betrayed. Lorenza had listened without interruption to the Crown Minister's version of the theft of the yacht.
So, it was that Serrano person after all, eh?
The Crown Minister seemed more interested in his ham with raisin sauce.
I suppose. Suppose she got tired of waiting for the court to rule. Silly, it might have ruled in her favor. There are all sorts of precedents for enforcing quite stupid wills.
Berenice is sure they'd have ruled against her. Even if she didn't poison Cecilia herself, it was clearly a matter of undue influence.
You women. I think you were convinced the captain did it just because she's another woman, and one who wears a uniform.
Now, Piercy, you know that's not fair. I have nothing against military women. I have the highest admiration for their courage and their dedication. But this woman was no longer military. She left under a cloud.
She was cleared.
Lorenza wondered why he was being stubborn. Did he know something she should know?
I understand that her own family, her own well-known family, didn't stand behind her. That tells me something. Even if she was cleared, they may know something that never came out in court. It wouldn't be the first time.
True.
He turned his attack to the ham, and then to the rice pilaf.
Berenice says Bunny's daughter Bubbles started acting odd after spending time with her on Cerealis. Wanted to change her name or something.
Bubbles has been acting like a fool since she hit puberty. It wouldn't take a yacht captain to send her off on another tack. Sorry, a nautical joke.
My point is that it's now perfectly clear she did something underhanded to influence poor Cecilia. And now she's stolen the yacht. Just what you'd expect.
Do you ever visit Cecilia?
Lorenza almost smiled at his transparent attempt to change the subject and make her feel guilty.
Yes, occasionally. I'm going tomorrow, in fact.
She had not been able to resist, after all. Twice now, she had sat beside the bed, her soft hand on Cecilia's unresisting cheek, and murmured into her ear, "I did it. I did it." That was all. No name, only the whisper. It excited her so she could hardly conceal it all the way home. And now she could be the one to tell Cecilia that her precious yacht captain had stolen her yacht, that she had been abandoned once more. If she had had any hope left, that should finish it. Lorenza let herself imagine the depths of that despair, what it must be like to have one's last hope snuffed out by a voice in the darkness. She was very glad she had specified that Cecilia's auditory mechanisms should be left intact.
This is the craziest idea I've ever heard. You want to take a sick, paralyzed old lady up in a hot air balloon, then bang around in a shuttle, and then... And what are you going to do when you get to Rockhouse Major?
I'm not going to Rockhouse Major. Dad's yacht is at Minor. That's all you need to know.
A balloon, damn it! You can't fly a balloon like a plane. They just drift. How can you possibly be sure you'll even get there? Or do you expect me to chase you across country on foot with Aunt Cecilia over my shoulder?
No, of course not. And yes, I can aim a balloon. There are ways. They're clumsier than planes, but quieter, and much more difficult to find on scans designed for planes and shuttles. I can be there within 15 minutes of a set time, and close enough that you won't have to run any races.
So what do you want me to do?
You visit her. You have a regular pass.
Yeah, but they're still watching me.
That's fine. They can watch you all they want. What's your regular visiting day?
Saturday, of course, when I have half day off. You know this already.
Yes, but I'm checking my own plans. Your mother visits on Tuesdays, and your father on Thursdays, and you on Saturdays. And you almost never miss.
I liked her.
Ronnie noticed the past tense and wished he had said like, even though it wasn't true. No one could like that limp, unresponsive body in the bed. And he had only Brun's conviction, formed in that one visit, that Cecilia the person still lived inside her inert shell. To give him hope.
So while they watch you and her, it's just routine. They expect you.
I still can't walk out with her.
You won't have to. All you have to do is to get her unhooked from the bed and outside. Like this.
Brun flipped open her note comp and showed him the plan. She had it all down, all the medical background, sketches of wires and tubes and things he didn't want to look at, what to do in which order, what he would have to take with him, suggestions for making sure the bothersome attendants didn't interrupt. He thought of another way himself and realized he was being drawn in. It still looked ridiculous, but Ronnie didn't argue. He didn't have anything better to offer. And the longer they left Aunt Cecilia trapped in her helplessness, the worse for her. He could hardly believe anyone could stay sane month after month.
When then?
Festival of the Air, of course.
Ronnie felt himself flushing. He'd been so miserable, he'd forgotten that annual celebration was almost upon them.
Plenty of confusion in the air. For some reason, the wilder sorts are thinking of dropping in on the Starchia resorts and sanctuaries in the area. Can't think of why. And no, it's not traceable to me. Now, let's get busy. You'll have to practice getting a flight suit on me when I'm lying limp.
Oblo had managed to load the yacht with a surprising number of amenities. Toiletries, leisure clothes, entertainment cubes, and a cube reader. Music discs and players. Despite the bare bulkheads and naked decks and the lack of furniture, ample bedding and bright-colored pillows made comfortable nooks for lounging and sleeping. Harris asked about the pillows. She could not imagine Oblo sneaking through the docks with big, puffy orange and puce and turquoise pillows under his arms, and he gave her his best innocent glare.
Bare decks get cold, Captain. You know that. And besides, these pillows, they were sort of lying about somewhere.
Somewhere?
Now he stared at the overhead.
Well, to tell you the truth, they belong to someone Meharry and I kind of blame for that girl Amelie's death.
Possibilities ran through Harris's mind, and she settled on the obvious.
That therapist?
He grinned as if he was glad she'd figured it out.
Yeah, she had this big room with lots of pillows in it. All needed cleaning. The cleaners picked them up and delivered them, and we sort of liberated them on the way back.
As a specimen of Oblo's vengeance, this was mild. Harris decided to let it go.
You know it was wrong.
So was getting Amelie killed and Sirkin hurt. It was the least we could do.
About what she'd expected. She managed not to laugh until he was out of her office. So far, the voyage was going well. Skodarin had not protested when she realized they were not, in fact, ferrying the yacht a short distance. She had been glad of a longer job, she said, and she trusted the captain. Harris found that amazing, but then the others were trusting her, too. Skodarin got along well with the others, though she was younger by some years than anyone but Sirkin. Harris wondered if that would turn into anything. She couldn't remember what Skodarin's preferences had been, if she'd ever known. Not that it mattered, really, as long as they both did their work. Sirkin she saw on the bridge. She was happily absorbing all Oblo and Gwar could teach her about the new navigational equipment. Hydar reported that Skodarin was as efficient as he remembered. All she had to worry about was the mission itself.
Oh, I just wish there were a way to be sure the crown offer was faked. Then we wouldn't have to bother with this ridiculous rendezvous. What if the prince doesn't show up?
She had never enjoyed covert ops, and didn't now. Petrus ignored that and kept rubbing her shoulders. Oblo had the bridge, with Arkady Janice to second him. Nothing would get by those two. She and Petrus had retired to her cabin, where they turned up the thermostat and lowered the lights so that they could enjoy the rest of the shift out of uniform. Surely this time nothing could interrupt them, not in FTL space.
What kind of job do you think we can get as cover if we need it?
His hands slid lower. She wondered if he really meant to continue a serious conversation, or if this was just another form of teasing. She was almost afraid to try the response she was eager to make. The obstacles to their pleasure had gone far beyond a joke. What would happen this time if they started something? She felt she would die of frustration if they didn't.
Soft side of legal, I expect.
Harris did not meet his eyes and leaned back against him. Maybe he would take the hint and continue without talking about it. Petrus shifted her in his arms, and she quit thinking about future problems. Present pleasure was enough for now. Apparently, he thought so, too. He quit asking silly questions. and nothing interrupted them. Though she didn't think of that for some time. But afterwards, they came back to it. A small tramp cargo ship couldn't simply idle along from place to place. It had to have cargo and destinations. Otherwise, as they knew well, the authorities would have questions, backed up with force.
It would be simpler if we had two ships. We could transfer cargo from one to the other as if... What was that?
Her convulsive lurch upset Petrus, who had been curled over watching her stretch. They collided, and then Harris was out of the bed, clutching the sheet and pointing at the bulkhead above him.
What?
Petrus glared first at her, then at the bulkhead. Then his gaze sharpened.
I don't have any idea.
He edged away from the bulkhead and got off the bed.
It's alive!
Harris was aware that her voice still hadn't returned to normal. The thing was just lighter than the bulkhead, a dull, creamy white, as long as her hand. It had long antennae. She could just see them wiggling.
And there's more than one of them.
Petrus pointed. Out of the crack between the bulkhead and bunk, two more of the things crept. Harris had wrapped the sheet tightly around herself. Now she leaned closer.
Six legs, antennae. You know what it looks like? It looks like an albino...
Something skittered down her leg from under the sheet and tickled her toes as it ran over them.
Cockroach!
She was out of the sheet before she knew it, and across the room. Shuddering, she looked back. Petrus, on one foot, looked around like someone who had forgotten what the other leg was for. Neither of them had anything handy for whapping a cockroach, because ships didn't have cockroaches. Ships were routinely cleaned out before and after each trip. Everyone feared vermin. Petrus was still on one leg like some kind of exotic bird.
Albino cockroaches? What do they eat?
Harris headed for the shower.
I don't know, but they're filthy. It's disgusting. On my ship!
She strode into the shower and bounced back out.
Oh, they're in there too!
Petrus was back on 2 feet, but looked anxious.
They like warmth, I recall. We turned up the heat in here.
Oh, and what if they're all over the ship?
Harris had a nightmare vision of a full-bore inspection arriving to find her and her first officer stark naked amid swarming albino cockroaches. Could she claim they'd eaten her uniform? Petrus shook out his shirt before putting it on.
They probably are, and they probably breed. Where could they have come from? None of us have been out of station quarantine.
That's why the redecorators didn't want us on the ship. They put them here.
But why?
I don't know. But we'd better find out. Maybe they're used in some stage of the redecorating process.
Petrus shook out his shoes one by one before putting them on.
That can't be legal. It's against all the regulations I ever heard of to have biologicals on a station or a ship, except for the registered ones like you told me Lady Cecilia had.
Harris checked her own clothes carefully before getting back into them.
I wonder. At least now we have a cargo.
These? They're not cargo. They're a reason to quarantine us.
Yes, but let's assume the decorators keep them and put them here. That means they're valuable to the decorators. That might mean they're valuable to another firm doing the same work somewhere else.
I don't see how. First, we'd have to catch them, confine them somewhere, take care of them. We don't even know what they're for.
Can you catch one?
Harris pointed to the cluster that still clung to the bulkhead over the bunk.
Me?
He looked at her. She looked back, pointedly.
Oh, all right. If they're poisonous or something, though, you better figure out how to save my life, or I'll haunt you.
I should figure out first what to keep it in. Let me think. Something in the galley should hold it. And we'll turn the temperature down in case they're more active in warmth. If I remember, most insects are.
Once clothed, she found the pale cockroaches just as disgusting, but less frightening. If they attacked, they'd hit her clothes and not her skin. She shuddered, remembering the touch of those legs. With the thermostat down, she had an excuse for shivering.
I suppose you want me to stay here while you fetch a cage?
I can stay. Get a food container with a tight lid, except we'll have to ventilate it somehow. I wonder what size holes these things can crawl through.
He came back with a canister whose top had a dozen perforations. Harris wondered why. Then it occurred to her it looked like a giant salt shaker. Perhaps that was how Cecilia's cook had covered pastry with powdered sugar.
We had similar things back home.
Petrus smacked the open end of the canister down over the nearest cockroach and carefully slid a flat piece of metal under it to trap it.
If Farmers hate them, too. They eat crops, clothing, pillows, rugs.
Rugs? Like the carpet that used to be here?
Yes, they ate holes in rugs. And upholstery, old-fashioned books, too, especially the bindings. My uncle said it was the glue. And they'd make a mess of data cubes left lying around, even though they couldn't eat them. They'd leave their mess on them, which glopped up the cube readers. Why?
Because that may be why the decorators have them. I hadn't really thought about it, but the stuff the decorators take out of a ship, all the wall coverings and carpet and upholstery, has to go somewhere. They'd have to pay to have it processed in the station recycler, and then they'd have to pay to replace that with new material, imported or fabricated, either one. Let me run the figures.
This was something she could work out once she thought of it. And the specifications were in the contract she'd brought along. She called them up.
Look, here's an estimate of square meters times minimum thickness of carpet, of wall covering, of upholstery, which comes to...
She looked at the volume result.
And they're required to give chemical composition, organics, so in case anything's volatile, what kind of outgassing the ship's environmentals will have to handle. Interesting.
What?
If they're honest, given the density and composition, the volume of material they'd have to have processed on station or transport would cost them...
She called in the financial subroutines.
Too much? Plus replacement? I'll figure that both ways. Local processing and importation. No, three ways. From planetary sources and importation from more distant sources.
The result exceeded the bid on Cecilia's job.
Well, it can't be. You've made a mistake somewhere.
I might have. But if I didn't, and if these disgusting insects were put here for a reason, and if they eat rugs and pillows and upholstery...
Well, they eat them. It might be cheaper to have them gobble up the client's old stuff, but unless they can be cooked into delicious banquet meals, I don't see how that helps. Unless, of course, they're cooked into something else. The new furnishings.
That's sick. Besides, how could you get them all back out?
Well, it would explain why they risk breaking the vermin laws if it did work.
And it gives us something to sell. Both the information and the, samples.
It certainly establishes us as outlaws. Selling vermin, carrying them loose on a spaceship.
Not loose if we can capture them. I don't want any more surprises.
Capturing the clots of pale cockroaches in Harris's cabin turned out to be easy, but everyone soon knew that those had not been the only ones aboard. Although their pale color made them hard to spot in some locations, they were obvious in the galley when someone flipped the lights on and they scuttered for dark corners. They swarmed to every food spill, and for a while, food spills were more common. Even Harris, who had convinced herself they were harmless, dropped a mug of soup when one ran up her arm. Eventually, the crew learned to tolerate the sight of them, or at least not drop things, but no one liked it. Nazaru Haidar came to the bridge, carrying the tiny object gingerly between thumb and forefinger.
What's this thing? And I already know it's not a dropping. I've learned to recognize those.
Petrus peered at it.
Egg case, and it's already hatched. Or they have. So they're fertile.
How fast do they reproduce?
I have no idea. Where I grew up, the entire life cycle of some insects was only 20 planetary days. And our days were close to old Earth days, they said.
And these insects were mature when introduced, possibly more than 10 days before we undocked. So they could have laid eggs immediately they came aboard.
It's possible that we undocked with only egg cases, and all the cockroaches on the ship are those who came with us as eggs.
So I couldn't have seen them.
Everyone had pointed out that he'd been aboard the ship stashing supplies. He'd insisted there were no cockroaches then.
Possible. What doesn't seem possible is getting them all. I wish we knew how long ago that had hatched. Are the ones we see now first or second generation? Or worse?
Haidar and Skodarin, with their specialty in environmental systems, seemed the logical ones to devise living quarters for the captured cockroaches and ways of eliminating those still loose. Harris hoped Cecilia would never need to know that she had had cockroaches running loose all over her ship. Brun waved at her friends as her balloon tugged on the mooring lines. Dozens of other balloons obscured her view of the hills. She signaled her handler, who released the line. She kept a steady burn as the balloon rose. A few were already high above her, bright colors hardly visible. a dozen released within a second of her release, and still more waited for a last passenger. The Festival of the Air. She remembered how she gasped the first time she saw all the balloons and kites and gliders and parasails. She'd had to learn to pretend disdain, even while learning to pilot a balloon. She'd claimed her father made her do it, but she'd always loved it. Surface winds pushed her back over the taller hills, away from her goal. She didn't hurry to rise above them. Half a dozen balloons she knew well were drifting as she was, toward the course marker on the highest hill 10 kilometers away.
Are you racing? I thought you declared non-competitive this year!
Declarations are secret. The wind doesn't lie.
Every year, some people pretended not to be racing until the race itself. It was one of the things she'd counted on. She let the balloon sag as it approached the next ridge of hills. With the wind behind her, she'd gain altitude here anyway, and she didn't want to be pushed into the contrary winds aloft. Not yet. She was still a couple of kilometers short of the first marker when she turned on the burner. She had let herself sag below most of the competitors, but that was her style. Slowly at first, her balloon steadied, then lifted, then surged upward, as if yanked by a string.
Damn!
The nearest balloon might or might not hear her over the burner, but anyone watching or recording her on Cube could see her mouth moving.
Burner's stuck on! I'm going to lose my wind!
She hauled herself up onto the basket rim and banged at the burner with a wrench as the balloon surged upward. Her stomach protested. She ignored it. It was no worse than a fast elevator ride. Around her, then below, the others receded to multicolored blobs. When she felt the wind shift, she whacked the burner control in the right place, which she'd been studiously missing, and turned it off. The balloon kept rising. It had plenty of heat in it, and the air at this level was cooler. She leaned out, watching all the other craft in the air. She knew what the winds aloft had been when she launched, but winds changed. She was drifting back now, away from the course marker, back past the launch site where balloons just launching looked like overstuffed sofa pillows. Half a dozen balloons were higher and ahead, well on their second race leg, having passed the first course marker before gaining altitude to ride the other wind direction. The morning's mist had cleared, and now the remnants thickened into clouds defining the boundaries of different air masses. She pulled the burner control and sent the balloon up another several hundred feet. Up here somewhere, she should find a current angling in from the approaching low pressure. Over there, where the clouds thickened into murk. Ronnie craned his head to look over the guardhouse at the first of the balloons. Of course, it wasn't time for Bruns yet. He looked at the guard, who smirked at him.
Festival of the Air. You like it, sir?
Ronnie allowed himself to look abashed. He had practiced the expression for 2 days now.
I know it's childish, but it's always been my favorite seasonal festival. If I hadn't had to come visiting today, I could have been up there too. Not that I don't love my Aunt Cecilia, of course.
A bit dull, visiting elderly relatives. They tell you all about their childhoods.
Well, not my aunt.
Ronnie was sure the man knew already. He had to assume that.
She can't speak, actually. She had a stroke.
I'm sorry to hear that, sir. Makes it harder to visit, I suppose. Although perhaps she can hear you. Give some sign that she knows you're there.
Ronnie felt cold. He wanted to smash the man's head on the ground.
No, they say not. She's just a vegetable, just lying there. But Mother says, I would come anyway. She's my aunt, but...
But not today, if you didn't have to. No shame in that, sir. At least you came. It speaks well of your family.
Ronnie nodded without speaking as the man held out a stamped visitor's pass. He could feel the man's eyes watching his back as he walked up the beautifully landscaped lawn. Could the man tell that he had something under his clothes, in his pockets? He glanced up and walked on with his head thrown back as if he could not resist watching the balloonists. As required, he checked in at the main desk, where he was told his aunt's room number. The same as always, he was relieved to note. Her condition was unchanged, the receptionist said. He would please observe the rules of the facility. He could have recited them by heart. No smoking, no alcohol, no eating in the room, no tampering with equipment or medication. He was free to use the toilet or drink from the water fountain. If he required something else, he could ring for an attendant. He could stay 2 hours, but he would have to leave immediately if his aunt required active medical treatment. He nodded, as always, and exchanged his entrance pass for a unit pass that gave him access only to his aunt's treatment unit. The receptionist, safe behind her counter, hardly looked at him except for a quick glance at his face. Sometimes they offered an escort. If they were busy, they didn't. This time, no staff member came to check on him, and he strode along a neat stone pathway edged with flowers, free to think without interruption. If they failed, his aunt would die. He was sure of that. Either they made a clean getaway, or whoever had done this would kill her. His mind suddenly forced on him an image of himself in Cecilia's state.
Or me.
He shuddered. Sweat ran cold down his back. He saw, without registering them, other people walking on other paths. Family members of other patients. Staff in the cheerful, bright coveralls they wore. The treatment units, low stone-faced buildings scattered among trees and lawns and flower beds, looked like expensive apartments. The path led him around one, then another. He saw a terrace outside one, with someone in a hover chair talking to two people in normal clothes. Off to one side, on a smooth stretch of lawn, a patient struggled to walk from a hover chair to a picnic table spread with food. At last he came to the final row of buildings, to Cecilia's treatment unit. Like the others, it was stone-faced and low, with a covered terrace on this side. The terrace on the far side had no roof. That should make it easier. He put his card in the door, which slid open. Inside, the expected staff member, this time the gray-haired man in yellow, who checked his pass, his ID, and reminded him again of the rules.
She's having a good day. And I've just finished toileting and bathing her. She's all fresh and sweet for you.
Thank you.
If she could see, she'd have a perfect view of the festival. At least you can enjoy it.
Ronnie wondered whether a fake sulk or a pretense of boredom would be better.
I wish I could. If I hadn't, I mean, my regiment's got a contestant up.
Ah, balloon or glider?
Both, of course.
Ronnie pulled himself up and tried for Pompous. It had been easy last year, when he still thought the regiment's place in the air races mattered.
Well, you can see them through her window. Or, if you wish, open the sliding door onto the west terrace. It won't bother her.
I'd better not. If Mother found out I was neglecting Aunt Cecilia to look at the festival, she'd skin me.
I won't tell. Go ahead.
I think she gets the tapes or something. She knew last week when I read for a half an hour.
He had read for half an hour, setting up this situation. His mother hadn't mentioned it, but he was sure tapes were being made, and someone at this level shouldn't know how many people got copies.
That's easy to arrange. I can put it on a loop for...
Oh, would you? I'd be terribly grateful. It can't matter to Aunt Cecilia. You're all very tactful about it, but the doctor said her brain was gone. And if I have to spend all today cooped up in here just looking at her and pretending to talk to her...
He held out his credit chip.
I'd like to buy a fruit punch, too.
The man fed the chip into the unit reader, flicking the buttons, and handed it back to Ronnie when it popped free. The cash, how much, Ronnie couldn't tell, never actually changed hands.
What you do is you go in there and act normal for about 10 minutes. Don't just sit still. Pour some water, touch her hand, sit down, stand up, talk to her softly. Then come out and go to the toilet. I'll loop the tape at that point, and only an expert will know you're just repeating things for the rest of your visit. See this button? Push it when you leave, and I'll put the tape back to real time.
Oh, thanks.
Ronnie had no idea if the man was honest or honestly dishonest, but it was worth a try. He went in, and for 10 minutes, that felt like 10 years, acted like a bumbling, nervous, miserable nephew. As near as he could, the same he'd acted in all his visits. He stroked Cecilia's cool, dry brow and her thin, wrinkled, flaccid hands, then turned away to wipe his eyes and pour himself a glass of water. Finally, he left and went into the toilet in the outer room. When he came out, the man in yellow stood by the outside door, gave him a final thumbs up, and left. Ronnie went back to Cecilia and sat there a little longer before letting himself look outside. Behind Cecilia's unit, the clinic land ran down to the river, a meadow mowed just too high for comfortable walking. He could see four or five balloons from inside the room, one quite low, but it was the wrong color. A parasail slid across, a long, low glide that ended with a landing at the far end of the meadow. Ronnie gave Cecilia a kiss on the brow, and then walked over and opened the glass door to the terrace. Balloons crowded above him. The air smelled fresh, the scent of mown grass mingling with a faint tang of smoke from the burners. People hung over the edges of baskets and waved. He waved back. Some balloonists could indeed steer, he saw. Not all used the same method, but he saw balloons wallowing across the wind with the aid of propellers, compressed air jets, and even oddly shaped rudders. All in brilliant colors, in stripes and stars and plaids. He took a quick look at his watch, then tried to peer upwind. She ought to be here soon. And he had to unhook his aunt from her monitors, praying that the attendant had been honest, that the tape was on a loop, that the loop included her monitors. He ducked back inside and put on the thin surgical gloves he'd brought. Inside his own shirt and slacks were clothes for her. Pants and shirt, socks, soft slippers. Folded flat between his jacket and its lining was a thin balloonist's coverall with garish stripes. Bubbles was supposed to bring something to cover Cecilia's hair.
I'm sorry about this.
Quickly, he threw back the covers. The sight of her thin white legs, her feet strapped into braces to prevent contractures, nearly broke his concentration. As gently as he could, he unstrapped them and struggled to put her socks on. He had never dressed even a child. He had no idea how hard it was to put socks on without cooperation. Then he lifted her legs and worked each foot into one leg of the slacks. She seemed so much heavier than she looked. He was having to tug and yank at her. He hoped it didn't hurt. Bubbles had warned him what he might find next. The tubes, the bags. He didn't want to think about it, let alone look at it or touch it. But he had to. He glanced, feeling the blood rush to his face, even though he was alone with an unconscious woman. Nothing. She must have had, his mind, avoiding the present, struggled for the phrases, that surgery which implanted a programmable sphincter control. Without really looking, he wrestled the slacks up to her hips, and with a skillful lift he'd practiced on Bubbles, all the way up to her waist. He wouldn't have made it without that practice. He should have practiced all the dressing, but he'd assumed it would be easier. Perhaps the attendants who cared for her did more than guard against intruders. His eyes registered the scars on her belly, but he refused to stop and stare at them. Now for the rest. He risked another quick glance outside and saw the rose and silver balloon in the distance. He had to work quickly. Trying not to feel anything at the sight, he pulled open the front of the clinic gown. He had to find the ports through which she was fed, suctioned, medicated. A flat, peach-colored plastic oval on her upper chest must be one. Three little caps stuck up like grotesque nipples. One blue, one green, one yellow. Behind her right ear, another plastic oval. This one with a silver nipple.
If the monitors don't use external wires, and most don't these days, they'll have built-in transmitters to either the bed with relays to a nursing station or direct to the nursing station.
He remembered that. Either sort could transmit up to 30 meters, which meant that nothing should show on the monitors, even if they were being watched, until Cecilia was more than 10 meters from the bed. He had that much time to get well away from the unit before the alarms went off. No external wires today, and nothing connected to the ports. It should have been simple, but the feel of his aunt's flaccid body as he pulled her forward, pulled off the gown, and worked her arms into the shirt made it difficult. Now the coverall. This was quicker, since it had been designed to fit loosely over clothes, and since he had practiced how to put it on Brun. Of course, she wasn't as limp, even when she tried to lie still. He rolled Cecilia up on one side and got foot and hand into the loose sleeves. He worked the coverall close under her, then rolled her back over, tugged, and fitted the second arm and leg in. Then the pressure seals. And now she looked like a fallen balloonist. A normal person, a real person. It must have taken hours. Bubbles would have drifted past. He was vaguely aware of sounds from outside. Hoots and cries and angry voices back toward the main buildings. Laughter and shouts from the meadow. He picked his aunt up, again surprised at how heavy she was, and moved near the door. The rose and silver balloon blocked his view upwind. He looked up to see Bubbles' white face staring back at him. The balloon sagged heavily, the basket scraping through the ornamental hedge between the next unit and this. It tilted half over before breaking free. Then it dragged along the ground and bumped the edge of the terrace.
Now, I can't stop it!
Ronnie lunged outside, clumsy with the weight in his arms. He staggered into the side of the basket. Bubbles grabbed his aunt by the shoulders and pulled. Together, they got her over the basket's rim and in, although she landed heavily, almost on her head.
Straighten her out! Get her head up!
Get back inside!
Ronnie wanted to protest, but her hand was already on the burner control. He looked around. Bubbles' balloon had blocked his view of the meadow and the air overhead. He hoped it had blocked others' view of the basket for that critical few moments. Now that it was past, he could see that the meadow roiled with balloons, parasails, even two gliders being hastily de-winged for transport. When he went back into the empty room, the open bed seemed to stab his heart. His eyes filled. Forcing himself to be calm, he checked the IV pump and stripped off the medicine label. It might or might not help, but it was worth a try. Then he pulled the covers up and went into the unit's front room. He badly wanted to use the toilet, but didn't dare take the time. Now he had to get out, to be seen leaving with nothing in his hands and no aunt slung over his shoulder. He reached for the outer door and remembered that he still had on those gloves. He was supposed to have put them in the basket for Bubbles to take away. Instead, he'd have to have them in his pocket, along with the medicine label. On the east terrace, he could see more of the confusion wrought by the Festival of the Air participants. Someone's balloon had caught its basket solidly in a large tree, and attendants and balloonists were having a loud argument about it. Several other balloons had apparently dropped baskets of confetti and party toys, which littered lawns and walkways.
We're just having a picnic, and we thought your old geezers might like to see a little color and life.
Over his head in the tree, a balloon basket dangled, its balloon slowly deflating. A dark-coated man Ronnie recognized as an administrator stood under it.
It's trespass!
Hi, Ronnie. Come to our picnic.
Ronnie peered up. The administrator he knew was watching him.
Oh, picnic? In a tree? What are you idiots doing this time?
We're headed down to the shore, but Corey had a bet with George on who could drop a marker square in the middle of the administration building.
Why?
It was the sort of thing George would think of. All they had told him was that they needed lots of balloons hanging around the nursing home on some ridiculous pretext. The girl, whom he vaguely remembered from last season, had dyed her hair in streaks of green and blue and wore a tan coverall with one blue and one green arm.
I don't know. Somebody said this would be a good place. Cheer up the patients who couldn't come to the festival. Anyway, why not climb up and come along?
Because you're not going anywhere. Not until you get out of that tree. Besides, your balloon is deflating. Haven't you noticed?
I told you you were too low, Corey. I'll be stuck here for hours, and the others will have all the fun.
You could ride with me. It's not as much fun as flying there, but much more fun than hanging in a tree like an ornament.
No! Unauthorized persons cannot just wander around unsupervised. You! Where's your pass?
Ronnie held it out.
Here. I'm on my way out. Couldn't I escort Andalase? It's not her fault.
She's an intruder. A trespasser.
Oh, come on. It's a festival. She's my date.
She didn't trespass intentionally.
The longer he stood here arguing, the more obvious it was that he didn't have his aunt hidden on his person. He told himself that the gloves in his pocket didn't really glow bright yellow either.
And it would get her out of your tree. Or I could help free the basket. It looks like you've got other problems, too.
The man handed Ronnie's pass back.
No. It would be most helpful if you would simply check out now. If we clear the property of legitimate guest, it will be easier to deal with these...
Well, if that's what you want.
Ronnie shrugged and turned away, looking, he hoped, like someone reluctant to leave. He gave a last glance up to the trapped basket.
I'll take your place, shall I, Corey? Sing by the bonfire and all.
You can't go. You aren't flying.
I can pick up a parasail at home. There's still enough daylight. Enjoy your treehouse.
Ronnie made himself walk slowly, looking up when a balloon's burner whooshed overhead, grinning and shaking his head when a shower of glittery confetti covered him in blue and turquoise. At the main desk, a crowd of visitors clustered, complaining about the noise and confusion, about being forced to leave early. Ronnie handed his pass to the harried receptionist with a shrug and a smile, and accepted the gate pass she gave him. Someone tapped his shoulder.
Isn't your aunt in that last row?
Yes, why?
All that noise. I saw one balloon land almost on top of that row, dragging the basket along.
Must have been after I left. It won't bother her, I'm sorry to say.
No?
The avid curiosity of the other man annoyed Ronnie, but he knew he must answer.
She's in a coma. Has been for months.
Oh, well, that's not so bad. But still, my father nearly had another stroke when he saw someone fall out of a basket and have to climb back in.
It's just the festival.
Ronnie turned away. He had to get out of here. He made it out down the long walk to the gatehouse in a clump of departing visitors. Another low-flying balloon nearly scalped him. Someone behind yelled a warning, and the guard at the gatehouse was shaking his head when he collected the gate passes. He had made it to his own vehicle. He had started it up. Others crowded the exits. He glanced behind, half expecting to see someone running to stop him. But nothing. He was on the road home. No one signaled him. No pursuit appeared. At home, he faced the tricky part. While his parents had agreed that something must be done, it had been clear that whatever was done must be done secretly. None of them ever discussed possibilities. For all he knew, they had their own plans to rescue Cecilia, and he had just ruined them. Then again, maybe they'd given up. But they certainly had no idea what he'd been part of. Suddenly, the casual self-invitation to the beach party sounded like just the thing. He left a message on the house board and went to get his parasail out of storage.
The Serrano Legacy Sporting Chance is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2002, Elizabeth Moon. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2008, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by Nanette Savard, Colleen Delaney, Sonny Lasky, Andy Clements, David Coyne, M.B. Van Dorn, Elizabeth Demery, Ken Jackson, Peter Stray, Christopher Graybill, Lily Beacon, Karen Carbone, Michael John Casey, Dylan Lynch, Terrence Aselford, James Lewis, Richard Rowan, Eric Messner, and Mort Shelby. Directed by Nanette Savard. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Chris Rowan. Additional original music by Chris Rowan. If you enjoyed Serrano Legacy, be sure to look for the Deathstalker series, available at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net.
The sea! It has withdrawn!
Withdrawn?
It has receded!
Tsunami! It's a tsunami! Run!
Working on a dig on the southern coast of India, the last thing Anya Creed expects is to be hit by a tsunami or to strike archaeological gold.
Hey! Look what I found!
Let me see that. It appears to be a mechanism of some sort.
Is it gold?
I believe so, yes.
Anya watched as Lochata's fingers found the hidden release inside the egg-shaped device. The device split open like the sections of an orange to reveal the figurine inside. It was a woman, at least from the waist up. But below the waist, she was a snake. Anya is driven to discover the source of the relics at the bottom of the sea. Unfortunately, She isn't the only one interested in the mysterious artifacts.
Where is Anya Creed? If someone does not tell me where this woman is, I'm going to set your ship on fire and kill every person aboard it.
I'm here.
Miss Creed. I am Rajiv Shivaji. Do you still have the figurines?
No.
I don't believe you. Do you really want me to kill all those people because you like me?
No.
Master Rajiv! Look! It's the Coast Guard!
They've underestimated me, Miss Creed, and they're about to pay for that.
Taken hostage by the pirate Shivaji, Anya finds herself on a river deep in the Indian jungle.
You know about Kumari Kandam?
It was a mythical kingdom out in the Indian Ocean.
Not mythical. Once it was very real. A proud and fierce people lived there for a long time, and they amassed a vast fortune. As the island began to sink, the people abandoned their city and fled to the mainland. They took the contents of the treasure room with them. There!
There! Men! Pull to shore!
We must find a throne room. That's where the treasure is supposed to be kept.
But the deserted ruin isn't deserted, and the residents don't like strangers. Rogue Angel number 10, Serpent's Kiss.